Testing, test. This is David Crippen of the Edsel B. Ford Design History Center at the Edison Institute in Dearborn, Michigan. And today is October the 7th, 1986. And we are in the beautiful Canadian Lakes Country, west of Mount Pleasant, and talking today with the well-known and longtime GM General Motors designer, Mr. Clare, C-L-A-R-E, is that correct? Yeah. Middle initial? M. McKeachan, M-A-C-K-I-C-H-A-N. Capital K, I'm sorry, capital M, lowercase A-C, capital K, lowercase I-C-H-A-N. Mr. McKeachan has had a long career with General Motors, including a pioneering stint at Opel in Rüsselsheim, Germany, the GM's overseas, European overseas affiliate. And we'll ask Mr. McKeachan to give us his career biography in his own words and at his own pace.
Well, I was born in the little town of Applegate, Michigan, which is in the thumb of Michigan, about halfway up the thumb. And I think I started to feel like I wanted to be a car designer. Well, I know in my earliest years in grade school, I started to draw little sketches on the borders of my books. And in any little notepaper that I had, if there was a moment of disinterest in whatever I was being taught, my pencil was busy making little sketches of cars. Only cars. And I was always interested in cars. And from early years, I can remember going to see the new cars in the showrooms or see them on the road when they first came out. And I followed all of the magazines and their ads and cut out the ads. Little scrapbooks. So there was never any doubt in anybody's mind what I wanted to do. And of course, it was fine with my parents. No problem with that at all. When it came time for a little higher education, my two brothers had gone to the University of Michigan, and I was taken for granted that I would probably go there too, which I did. And there were no schools available that I knew of at the time to teach automotive design.
What year was this?
1934, I started at the University of Michigan. So I studied engineering, mechanical engineering, with some architectural courses to try to help my artistic ability. It wasn't too good training, but it was the best that I knew of. Some SAE meetings in Detroit as a student member. While I was there also, I had some articles published in our local publication, SAE student publication.
That was rather good for a young would-be engineer to have student membership in SAE.
Yes, it was. Very good. And in that way, we got to meet some of the people in the Detroit branch. I know this one article included some sketches that I had made. And this was late.
You still have them?
if I do, they're in Florida.
Oh.
And I'm not sure that I still have them. I've moved around so much that I lost so much stuff. I completed my mechanical engineering studies got a B.S. in mechanical engineering, and then started in 1938 to get a master's degree. I think I was only about 2 months into that, and I had got the idea of leaving and going to one of the automotive companies. I used some of this information from the article that I had written to get this job, and as a result, I went to Briggs Body.
This was in 36?
38.
Briggs was, at that time, was a an arm of what company?
Well, they were their own company, but they had a, under John Jarda, D-J-A-A-R-D-A,
right.
Hollander, they had a small design section.
I see.
I really don't remember how many people they had, but I would guess 40 people, 50 people, which would include designers and clay modelers and engineers. And they were very active in those days.
This was really a fledgling discipline, wasn't it? In spite of how the girls having started the unit.
Yes, well, I think, I know that Jarda and Harley Earl knew each other, but I don't think they were friendly. They were competitors.
And Briggs would have contracts with several companies.
Briggs had contracts with Ford Motor Company. They did work for Chrysler. They did work for Nash, which became American Motors. And they had done work for Hupmobile and some others in prior years, you know, when Hupmobile was trying to stay alive.
Right.
I think at one time Murray Body did some of the same kind of work, but it was much smaller. And I think John Jarda is the one that had pulled all this together. And do you remember the special cars that John Jarda did? There were two of them. One was the design became the Lincoln Zephyr.
When the concept car did for the 34 World's Fair.
Right, that's it. For rear engine,
right.
A very smooth, very slippery kind of car. And then they did another version of that with the front engine as a Ford, and was smaller, but somewhat similar in basic design. And you remember it was rather round and had no drip moldings. It was
called a teardrop shape.
Well, I don't know if they used that term, I suppose.
Retrospectively, you might call it a teardrop.
But it was way ahead of its time.
Mm-hmm.
It was excellent. And I understand. I've heard, and I believe this is true, that Ferdinand Porsche made a visit to the United States and was taken to see this car. And he took a lot of notes, probably photographs, and went back to Germany and later developed the Bug. And if you'll remember the design of those two cars, Volkswagen Beetle, they're very similar.
Very similar.
The rear windows are the same with the split, and the general contours are the same, and the lines on the side are the same.
Rear engine.
And it was rear engine. Yeah. And I firmly believe that what John Jarda had done became the Volkswagen Beetle.
I've heard that. Have you ever established what year of Porsche visited the Detroit?
No.
That's the mystery. Exactly what he got here.
I think the time frame is right.
Is
I think
persuasive?
It could have been done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have any idea what happened to that prototype?
I have no idea.
Was
I have
the property of Ford Motor Company?
Well, I would assume it was.
Yes.
I would assume both of those.
Or did Charlie take them back?
Well, I would think. I know nothing about that part of it. I would think that this was done under contract to Ford Motor Company,
right.
And therefore it would be Ford Motor Company property.
So
seems right.
When you got to Briggs in 1938, the Zephyr had already come out.
Yes.
Production.
Yeah, this was much before I went there.
Right. That is an interesting story.
Yes, I kept copies of all the magazines of things that were of interest, both in Europe and the United States, dealing with automotive design. What I was saying seems so logical, I firmly believe.
Were you hired by Charlie?
Yes.
What sort of person was he? We don't know too much about him.
Well, John Jarda was a very strong man in many ways, like earlier. He ran the place firmly. I think he may have done some things that may not have been quite the way the people who he is under contract from wished it. I know, for example, that concurrently he was doing, maybe I should say, he was doing things that were Nash, Chrysler, Ford, and he would sometimes, when he was having a visitor from Chrysler, he would put the whole crew on that job. Ford was around, he'd pull them all off and put them on their job. And I don't know what he charged time for, but he also had a little engineering program that he was working with the U.S. Navy on, and he also had another engineering program trying to develop a car that would bank on the corners. And it was done with the linkage, a parallelogram linkage in the suspension. I don't know how they got the springing in with this, but as the car went around the corner, it would lean into the corner.
Yeah.
It was a nice idea.
Nice.
And I don't think anybody ever used it.
Really? Would it have been feasible?
I don't know.
Standpoint?
I don't know. It must have been somewhat feasible, or they couldn't have gotten people to contract for it. But he had young German who had the original idea and was trying to sell it to somebody. Jarda picked it up.
Do you remember what his name was?
No, I don't. That was a long time ago. I don't remember any of the names of the people that I worked with except Phil Wright.
W-R-I-G-H-T?
Yes.
I heard of him once.
And apparently he worked on the court and claimed some credit. Four quite good designers. Did I say Phil Wright's the only one I can
read? Was Ralph Roberts there?
Ralph Roberts, no. Can you fill me in a little bit on Ralph Roberts?
Ralph was a senior man at Griggs under Chardon. He stayed on until wartime. And I'm not sure if this is true about that. He worked on a number of key designs. Still alive, by the way. There's a great album. I wanted to interview him this year.
Well, I guess he was still around. I don't remember hearing much about him.
What were your duties then?
Oh, I was just the most junior man on the staff. I did whatever they told me and observed what design was all about. And I suppose I got into some clay modeling.
Good learning.
My skills were not honed too sharply at the time. But it was a very interesting time in my life because this was the beginning of design training for me, and I could observe what others were doing. Incidentally, I understood that Jules Andrade spent a year or some months at Briggs before I got there. By the time I got to General Motors, he was working under Carter.
So it was probably the best place you could have gone in terms of initiation for a career.
I think so, because I could see the whole design picture there.
Right.
I wasn't stuck in one corner doing one kind of thing.
You were working for several companies.
Yes, and I could see a little bit about how they operate.
How long was that?
I was only there 6-7 months. And so then this was in 1938, in the fall of 1938, probably October, November, I guess, that I went there. And then I think it was May of 1939, about this school that General Motors was starting for budding designers.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to General Motors and applied there and was accepted. And I talked to Howard O'Leary.
He was sort of the administrative head of the design.
Yes.
Was he a sympathetic?
Howard O'Leary was the most sympathetic, nicest Irishman that you ever heard of.
Perfect for that.
Smoothest job. Talking, uh-huh. And you know, always your friend.
Come to me if you get into trouble.
Yeah, and there was a lot of trouble, but he was always the fellow who sort of smoothed things over. So I went there in May of 39, and this was a school of people from any place in the country, could be another company, but they were hiring new designers, and this was under Reg Bennett. Came from, they don't know where he went after during that period of time he ran the school.
Where was the school located?
It's located in the GM building.
Uh-huh.
On Cass Avenue. Fourth, fifth floor or something like that. And I think there were probably, let's say, 10 of us. Problems that we were given problems, design problems, by Reg, and they were reviewed occasionally by Jules Andrade or someone on staff, and he would bring some of his friends occasionally just pass through and see what we were doing and how we were getting along. And I think about every 3 months there was a little weeding out.
Mm.
Maybe not the first 3 months, but over a period of time. We continued that for almost a year, and then they stopped the program. Some of us graduated and some of us didn't, to work in the design center, or I should say styling department.
What were the criteria for retention at that point? Looking back on it, do you see any?
Well, there were some people that just obviously couldn't make it, and that was seen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They just weren't doing as well as they should.
Were the problems you were given design-oriented or engineering?
Design.
Design.
Solely design.
Yeah. Did your engineering background kind of help?
Well, I don't think in that period it would make any difference. No, it was a matter of being able to think of ideas and put them on paper. You know, intelligible way.
Right. Did your curriculum at the art and architecture schools at the University of Michigan stand you in good stead?
No, I really couldn't get much out of that. I think up to that point it was pretty much self-taught.
Yeah.
I looked for classes in the architecture school, but other than showing me how to use certain design materials. Yeah. It wasn't too good.
So really your facility in design was pretty much a something that came up from your own desire and your own need to pursue this kind of career.
I suppose there were some things that I got out of the architecture school, a little bit of perspective training.
Yeah.
That helped, and use of colors and material.
Were there instructors in this group?
In
Reg Bennett was back in the
well, yes.
School.
Yeah. Occasionally, someone would come over from the permanent staff and talk to us and help us out, show us things.
You probably heard of Harley Earl by this time. Had you ever seen him? Did he ever come into the school?
I don't believe he ever came into the school. I don't think Howard O'Leary ever came into the school. But of course we'd heard from him because he was gone.
Right.
And occasionally we would see him on the street.
Very imposing.
Oh.
Very tall.
Well, I'll tell you, there were some times when he looked to be about 8 feet tall. And
very stocky. Not stocky, but very muscular.
Yeah, but he was slim, but big.
Yeah. Very sharp dresser.
So after I had completed the school, I was hired into the styling department in a special project studio, and that was under Jules at Agramonte.
A-G-R-A.
M-O-N-T-E.
Accent over the
yeah.
E. Accent.
And I think somebody was hired into one of the other studios, but probably for the first few weeks, Gene Bournay and Ed Nichols and I and the others were working in that studio. And I think that was the reason for that studio was primarily just to kind of integrate us into the functioning of the whole place and see how it operated. And during that period of time, we could go not into the studios, but we could go into the shop areas and see how they were building things and what other things were going on.
In the fabrication.
Mm-hmm. And that was very interesting. I don't know how long I spent there, probably 6 months. And then I moved to the Buick studio, and that was under Al Boca, B-O-C-A. And Ned went somewhere else, and Gene went somewhere else. That was a very interesting period too, because for the first time I was working on an actual car, and whatever I contributed might see the daylight out on the marketplace. The kind of things that I did, of course, were small things like ornaments and taillights and little emblems and that sort of thing. I don't remember any one thing that I did or about anything, but.
What model Buick were you working on? This
well,
is 39 still.
That would be late 39, so we were working on probably the 41. And 41 was, as I recall, was a facelift year, so there really weren't a lot of things to do on the car. And then we got into 1942,
uh-huh.
which didn't last very long because of the war. There were a lot of interesting people that I met in the studio, and a lot of things that I had a chance to observe because for the first time I could see Harley Earl coming into the room and saying what he wanted. And as I said, I worked under Al Boca, and I don't know what Al's background was, but it wasn't really design.
But he was chief of the Buick.
He was chief designer of Buick for several years. During the time that I was in the Buick studio that I first met Joe Szymanski, S-C-H-E-M-A-N-S-K-Y, and I'll probably talk about him later on because he could sort of followed along or came along with me through a lot of my career and eventually went to Australia as chief designer or director of design for Holden.
Holden. It's the GM. Australian.
Yes, this was
artists.
Shortly after I went to Germany with Opel. But Joe was probably my best friend in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And we palled around a lot together and talked a lot together. He told me a lot of funny stories about things in the past.
Was he a little bit older than you were?
Well,
about the same.
A couple years.
Yeah.
A couple years. And his training was a little different. But he was a very interesting guy. In fact, I think he was assistant chief designer
Tom Bogus.
It was during this period that I first came into any contact with Harley Earl. And when I say contact, it was contact between somebody at a very low level and somebody who was standing up on the clouds. But Harley Earl, as you know, was a big man physically and
intimidating
as hell, really intimidating. And a person in my position was actually an abject terror of the man, because he would come in and just command everybody's attention without saying anything.
Did he have a loud voice, by the way?
He had a fairly loud and a very firm voice.
And it was the voice of authority.
And sometimes his eyes were so red, you could hardly see the pupil. Maybe it's conjunctivitis, is it?
Or allergy.
I don't know. But anyway, he really commanded everybody's attention. And I can remember, and probably it was in the Buick studio during that period, that I was put to work, not as a designer, but as a clay modeler helper one evening, because we had a show set for 8:30 the following morning, and this model was far from being done at 5 o'clock at night, and everybody just had to work, and if it was 3 o'clock in the morning or 6 o'clock in the morning, which I worked all day and all night quite a few times, it wouldn't make any difference. And I remember one night being under the model, on my back on the floor under the model, applying chrome foil or something on the car, and I heard this noise and heavy walking of feet outside, and I looked out, and there's Harley Earl dressed in his yachting costume along with some of the Fisher Brothers and some other notable people, and they were coming in from a party at the yacht club, I suppose, at 1:30, 2 o'clock, just to see how we're doing.
Were they going to be ready by 8:30? You know?
There was no question about that.
See.
We would be ready.
Or else.
We would be ready. And a person in my position would never talk to a man, because I wasn't supposed to.
Don't speak unless you're spoken to.
Right. But anyway, he was a real leader, and he had an innate sense of what was the right thing to do, I believe. And he commanded not only our attention because we worked for him, but he commanded the attention of the other vice presidents in the corporation and all his acquaintances. He made sure of that.
Yeah.
And his, since he had the close friendship of the top people in the corporation, he could do this. And I believe that he had all of the divisional heads and the other vice presidents all feared him to a certain extent, because he was such close friends with the top management.
I guess the Fisher brother, Larry Fisher and Albert Sloan had hired him.
Yes, and Sloan was his friend. Never buried. Sloan found him and brought him in and saw that he would always be successful.
A beautiful combination.
Wonderful situation.
Except for the apprentices putting foil on the
mountain. Well, this was in 1940. We still remember the Depression. We still knew that a job was a valuable thing, and we tried to maintain that.
The pay well in those days? What was the pay scale?
Well,
this is your first paycheck.
It was not very good. I think the pay when I entered the design school was $125 a month.
How about when you first
hardly
viewed it?
I can only guess. I don't remember, but it was low 200s. But it was enough for me to get married.
Pretty good.
Because other things were relatively cheap.
Right. Did you have pensions or any sort of benefits in those days?
I don't know, because that was not, I wasn't interested at that age.
You're right.
I didn't care.
Right.
I wanted design.
Right.
That was my sole interest.
Right. But this time it become an obsession. In the sense that this is what you wanted.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was it. I had no other interest. Absolutely no other interest. Well, maybe we better...
You better get back?
Yeah.
Why don't we finish off this side? We've got a few minutes more.
Right.
In fact, we're very close to it.
Well, I think one other thing, Harley Earl, I also had such an influence.
You were saying about Harley Earl and his chief lieutenants.
Yes, he had the same kind of influence on his top people. Not quite as bad as with me, because I was on the floor pasting paper on the model, but he ran the show, no question about it. And he told Jules Andrade what he wanted done, and that's what got done. And there really wasn't much arguing with him, because when he said it, that was it. And I think Harold Lurie was somewhat the same way, except he had an entirely different way of handling things, having that easygoing Irish wit
and
so that he got along fine with him.
Would O'Leary be a buffer sometimes between the...
Oh, yes.
Between the designers and Earl, perhaps taking their sides.
Well,
if there was a dispute and he knew that Earl was in the wrong, would he somehow try to smooth it over?
Yes, but it took a couple hours to do this. I've seen, and you may have heard this story before, but I've seen people walk down the hallway, and if they had a slightly ungainly walk or something that Harley Earl walking behind them didn't like, I'd say to Harley, "Who is that? Get rid of him."
Didn't like his walk.
Didn't like his walk. And then Howard would, he would maybe fire the guy, or maybe call him up into his office and talk with him, and then reinstate him. Maybe the next day, or maybe a few hours later.
That's good. Thank heavens for Howard Leary.
And I have had a few such
really?
Things.
How did that happen?
Well, I thought we'd get into that a little bit later.
Okay, good. Well, your comment a moment ago on that kind of episode was, run again, the way Earl ruled his domain through
fear.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that this sort of thing probably happened with Harley Earl's full accord, in that he would fire somebody knowing full well that Howard would get him up in his office, calm him down, and reinstate him, and this really caught your attention.
So the rebel became the convert and was a loyalist.
From then on.
From then on. Well, there you are, nicely ensconced in the Buick studio and enjoying yourself, your first real studio assignment. What sort of jobs did they have you do in the Buick studio? What sort of regiment did you have there?
Well, we were pretty much wide open to design various parts of the car, but for example, on the 1941 car, which was a facelift of the previous car, there wasn't anything major to do, so I think I spent most of my time designing ornaments, emblems, taillights, that sort of thing. Then when it came time for the 42 car, which was an all-new car, perhaps you remember that. It had a long front fender, which was bolted to the front. The fender came back to the door, and then there was a piece bolted onto the door, or doors if it was a four-door, which went back to the rear fender. It had a long sloping line on top, and it had two long chrome rub rails on the side, concave in shape. And it was quite a chore to build those in the plant to keep them even. The lines tended not to agree with each other. And I remember one time the studio was taken up to the Buick plant and walked through the plant. And I suppose Buick arranged this as a lesson to we styling people, mm-hmm. not to create that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Because as we walked down the assembly line, we could see people with huge, big hammers beating on those parts on the door, trying to get them one to agree with the other, to make the lines and the highlights agree.
Ball being hammered so that they would...
Sometimes the doors wouldn't close, so whack. I don't know how the cars went through it. I stayed with the Buick Studio until early 42, and this was after Pearl Harbor. And it became obvious that General Motors no longer needed an active styling department to design cars. And
was there any sort of directive to that effect? Did you get the word from anyone that we were going to disperse?
Well, I think we were all in fear that we were going to be let go one way or the other.
Right.
General Motors did keep in some of their people on doing camouflage work, you know, any excuse they could have to keep an organization still there.
Some of you with drafting and engineering experience have a chance to move elsewhere?
Well, perhaps we could have, but I don't remember that. And I ultimately left, or I was told that I was through there for the duration of the war.
Mm-hmm. And you weren't offered anything else at GM?
I don't recall that I was, nor was I looking for it, because I went to out in the tool and die design field. If there were a number of new companies starting up or working during the war doing tool design, and they needed detailers and designers, and when I say designers, I mean tool designers.
Right.
And I joined the ranks there.
Especially those with engineering background.
And those organizations worked 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. They had piles of work to do, and they did it on a cost-plus basis, and that was probably the best way for a person like myself to earn a little money.
Right.
Much better than I had been paid, if you don't mind working those kind of hours.
Were they subcontracting from the U.S. government?
They were subcontracting from other companies.
Other companies.
The other companies may have had contracts with the government. They would subcontract a job. When that was through, maybe the place would close down or almost close down.
Mm-hmm.
But there were others. All you had to do was
move from one to the other.
Move from one to the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for several years.
All through Detroit, pretty much.
Yeah.
Greater Detroit area.
Yeah.
Any of the companies that you worked for have any of them survived to this day?
Well, I don't think so.
You don't think so? They're all small job shops.
Yeah. That's what they were, job shops. And then later on, I went to...
But there was no dearth of work. You could
that's
practically
right.
Be employed.
Yes.
Continuously.
Yeah, and when I was in college, I was in ROTC, and I had a commission.
Oh, yes.
I didn't get an actual commission afterward. I tried to, but I was turned down because I had high blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what allowed me to continue in this kind of operation. And then later on, when Ford Motor Company got involved in the B-24.
Right.
And they were going to build it at Willow Run, but the engineering was being done in Dearborn.
Right.
I went with them for 6 or 8 months.
Did you really?
And
some of the early detailing on the B-24?
And then after that,
I... Do you remember anyone that you worked with there that stayed with Ford, or that was fairly well known?
Well, what was the man's... There was Sorensen, and who was the man that worked for Henry the First? He was sort of the policeman.
Oh, Harry Bennett.
Harry Bennett.
Uh-huh. Right.
And I think it was a relative of his, a cousin, nephew, or something that ran this department.
Okay.
Sort of in the same way that Harry Bennett would run it, I think.
Probably. Like a police station.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't remember what I did during that time. It wasn't of importance. Afterward, I went to Fisher Body in their engineering area, and we were working on the B-29.
B-29, the big
one. Because we built, GM built parts for that in Cleveland,
uh-huh.
and the engineering was done in Detroit. So I worked in the hydraulic engineering department. I learned about hydraulic engineering,
mm-hmm.
and I did that for a year and a half or so.
You learned under forced draft.
And then afterwards, I went to the Fisher Body Styling Department, which was a small styling department that handled interior items. And I guess I stayed there for about 8 or 9 months. And it was not of much interest to me. I didn't like what they were doing. And that was,
where was that located?
That was located in the GM building. But as soon as I could, I went back to GM Styling.
And where was that?
Well, that must have been in the 46.
Just getting underway for the post-war.
Yeah.
Cars.
Yeah.
What had happened to Earl during the war? What did he do? Did you ever find out what he did? Did he stay on at GM or did he go into?
No, he stayed on at GM, but I don't know really. He had a good time. I don't know what he did.
Didn't he establish one of his private company at that point?
Around that time, I guess it was after the war, I believe.
I guess he was fooling around.
And his brother was involved in it eventually.
Yeah.
Bill Mitchell was ran it for a while. And I think probably one of the reasons that he got Bill in was to educate him in the way of business. Good training.
Had you known Bill when he was with Cadillac in the late 30s? Bill Mitchell?
Yeah, I worked for him. For a short period of time. There was a short period that I was in that studio before I was moved out. I guess it was before the war. But it was only for a short period. I didn't know him well
yeah.
at that time.
So what studio do you go back to?
I went back to Buick Studio again.
Oh, good. Okay.
And that was under Henry Love.
How do you spell that?
L-A-U-V-E.
Uh-huh.
Actually, it's Henry D. Segur, S-E-G-U-R, Love.
Uh-huh.
And
franchise.
As far as I know, he's still in Grosse Pointe.
Uh-huh.
Have you ever interviewed him?
No.
He ran that studio a large part of the time that I was in the Buick Studio. He was moved up to head all interior design. And there was a sort of major reorganization.
What sort of person was he?
Henry? Well, he was very congenial, very fine. I think a tasteful, good designer.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Liked to have a good time outside of the studio.
Uh-huh.
And as a result, a lot of the time he wasn't there.
So it was fun to work for.
And this was in a period when we used to, it was a completely different organization than it is today or was when I left
mm-hmm.
GM.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it was still small enough that it was a family.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to have big annual picnics, which were really great fun. Lasted into the wee hours.
This was something that Harley Earl instituted.
Yes, because Harley knew that we worked hard,
yes.
long hours, and so he would do things to make up for it. I guess our wives didn't agree with him making up for it because his long hours kept us away from home an awful lot of the time. And then there were other parties that he would throw. We used to, especially later on, during the period of our big Motorama shows in New York, people would work there almost 24 hours a day for several weeks prior to the show. And even so, they'd still be working on the train going to New York to finish a project. And then after that was done and everybody came back, he would throw up a party. Those were fun days.
I suspect so. What sort of assignments did you get in the Buick studio?
Well, again, some of the minor kinds of things, but we got into some big changes because after the war we had all new products to design.
Mm-hmm. Did you do a couple of facelifts for the first year or so?
Yes, sure.
When was your first post-war, new post-war viewing?
Well, I think that was just 42.
Oh, face up, yeah.
What year? Very minor changes.
When did you first start working on the all new post-war viewing?
That would be 48.
So you were just getting into that, probably.
Right.
Who was the chief of the, you said, it was Henry Love.
Henry Love for a while, and then Nichols.
Yeah, Nichols took over after him.
So I think Ned was in charge of it by the time the 48 was well underway. And you haven't talked to Nick yet, have you?
No.
Well, he...
Tell me a bit about him. I don't know much about him.
He was a good leader, and he knew the Buick people very well.
Mm-hmm. The general manager. Who was it at that time?
Harlow Curtis was a man who I always thought typified what a general manager or a president of Buick should be.
Mm-hmm.
Very smooth acting, very fine character in the way he looked. He was well groomed and he smoked a cigarette in a certain way.
Uh-huh. He had a flair.
He had a flair and he was a good leader.
Mm-hmm. Was he a good carman?
Yeah, I think he was.
He'd come up through the engineering ranks. Sales.
I had the idea that it would be sales.
I think you're right. I'm
not positive about that.
Right. Yeah.
But he had just a great way of talking. And he would, I happen to know this because for the 19, maybe it's getting a little ahead of the story, but the 1950 Buick, I had done a large full-size front end drawing of a front end. And that front end had for a grill, there were some large grill bars fastened to the bumper.
Mm-hmm. Bumper.
And then a header bar that went over it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had completed this drawing, and I knew that the next day Buick was going to, when I say Buick, I'm talking about Curtis, Ragsdale, who was chief engineer, Reynolds, who was in charge of interiors and a few other things.
Reynolds?
Reynolds.
Yeah, R-E-Y-N-O-L-D-S.
And,
what was his first name?
Ed.
And Mr. Ragsdale?
Ed Ragsdale and Ed Reynolds.
Right. Yeah.
And Chain, Charlie Chain. Charlie Chain was the chief engineer, that's right. And Ragsdale, I guess, was manufacturing at the time. But they were the group that always came down to make past judgment on new things.
I spelled Chain.
C-H-A-Y-N-E. So I came in the next morning, I probably got there at 8:15, and here's Harlow Curtis, Chain, Ragsdale, and Reynolds in the studio, and they had come in about 7 o'clock in the morning. Well, this all happened because Curtis had had a dream the night before, and the design that he had picked in the dream turned out to be a no-good design. As a result, he woke everybody up early in the morning. They got on the plane, flew down, and were in the studio at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Where had they been previously?
In Flint.
Oh, they flew down to Detroit.
They just flew down from Flint.
Right, okay.
And they had already seen my drawing, and Harlow Curtis walked over and shook my hand, and he said, "That's what I want."
Uh-huh.
And that's one of the things that I always admired about Curtis. He always, if he saw something he liked, he said, "That's it.
Uh-huh.
We'll do it that way."
Decisive. So, and
as a result, that front end, with a few modifications, became the front end on the 1950 Buick.
Great.
So I guess probably that was my first...
First breakthrough.
Breakthrough on anything big.
Mm-hmm.
One thing about Ned Nichols, he had a lot of ideas about things that he wanted to see. Mm-hmm. One of the things that he always liked, or pushed. Remember the portholes in the Buick?
The early portholes.
That was Ned Nichols' idea.
Mm-hmm.
And what he really wanted was to have actual exhaust pipes come out and come out those holes.
Uh-huh.
Well, this turned out to be not too practical.
Especially in Fender.
But he did push it through to the point where he had to,
at least had the holes.
He had the portholes. And he had, and his own car, he had some portholes made up prior to their acceptance and put on the car. And
what year did those portholes first appear?
Well, it must have been
48. 48, yes, right.
48. But he had them put on his 47.
Ah.
And it attracted enough attention that Buick accepted them.
Could they act as air dampers in any way? I mean, air intakes?
Not really. They didn't need anything like that.
No.
There wasn't that much need for it. But, you know, in those days, the way things looked, not
you
it didn't have to be functional.
Right, you needed some a gimmick to attract public attention. That certainly did.
I remember that because at one time I made up a little bird's nest and put in one of the portholes in Nick's own personal car, which didn't make him too happy.
He didn't appreciate it.
He didn't appreciate it.
What sort of a fellow was he? Was he fun to work for, or was he a bit moody, or?
Oh, he was fun to work for, and very interested in what you did.
Good. Yeah. Appreciative, supportive. Yeah. Convivial? Could you go out and have a drink with him?
Oh, absolutely. He insisted on it.
Okay. But he was a creative designer.
Yeah.
You had to be quite a splash in those early post-war.
Yes, they did. One of the things that Nick did on his own personal car was to put little flashers in those portholes.
Really? Actuated by electricity, or were they reflective?
How did he do that? All I remember was that you could see the flash right in the porthole, and they would, you know, like a spark plug. Ridiculous.
I seem to recall some story about that. Someone turned them into musical notes. Some people would decorate them because you would have the staff coming.
Well, I don't remember that.
You would have lines as if on a score sheet and turn into a little melody.
Could be.
Yeah. Well, those were heady years right after the war. You had a seller's market and.
That kept going too for a number of years after the war.
Buick was especially popular.
Yeah, the Roadmaster, the Super.
Some of those names were pre-war, holders were pre-war, I think Limited was. Who came up with the word, the Roadmaster?
Well, I don't know. I assume it came out of the Buick organization, and it might have been Curtis.
Product planning. Anyone else in the studio that you remember with some affection or perhaps disdain? Any of your colleagues that later like that?
I remember one time I had ordered my first new car was a 47 Buick, 46 Buick convertible. And where our Buick studio was situated, we could look out and down below, and we could see the Buick dealer, so we could watch the cars driving up and being unloaded. So I, for days, I sat there watching to see when my car would be unloaded from the truck. And it was a dark blue, metallic blue with a beige top. And I finally saw it, one like it anyway. And I called the dealer and to find out about it. Well, my friends, so-called friends, had kind of set me up. And one of them called back and said, "Well, Mr. McKeegan, I'm very sorry to have to tell you this, but we were servicing your car, which just came in, and somebody dropped a can of oil on the top, and it's discolored it a bit, and we'll try to correct it." And, you know, I was sick.
That's spoiled.
I was sick. Here's my first brand new car,
and
somebody's wrecked it. And so there was a lot of back and forth and calling and calling, and I think it was a day and a half before I finally tumbled and somebody was pulling my leg, and it was all right.
Who was that? Was that your own?
Well, Nick was one of them.
I'll bet, yeah. Obviously, that hadn't happened in your top was...
No, the car was fine.
You'd gotten married by this time.
Well, I was married in 1940.
40, uh-huh. Any children during these war years?
Yes, we had a girl in 1941.
Uh-huh.
And then every
few years,
three or four
so.
Years, there was another one. I have four children altogether.
Four children, uh-huh. Where were you living in those days? What suburb did you pick? Or Detroit?
We lived in Southfield.
Southfield,
near 8 Mile and Southfield Road.
That was fairly early on for Southfield.
Yes, it was. Yeah, it was a brand new area at the time.
Right. Yeah. So you watched it grow for them.
So we lived there for until around 1958, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And we moved to Farmington.
Ah, nice area. So, how many years were you at the Buick studio in your second term of duty there?
Well, I think in about 19. 49, I was moved to head up a special studio. They had a number of special studios, and special didn't mean very much, except that it would handle certain specific jobs other than divisional, direct divisional.
You were out of the mainstream of divisional design.
Yes, we might be used to do an alternate design for a studio or a division. Might be used to handle some small project. And the one that I was in, one of the small projects that we did was a facelift for an Opel. That was the first Opel work that I had done.
The GM had bought the Opel Motorworks, the Adam Opel Motorworks way back in the 20s, didn't
it? Right, late 20s.
Late 20s.
27, 28, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
And during the war, that plant was just...
commandeered by the Nazis.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
And then we bombed it.
We
and it
did.
Was, it was about 50%, 60% destroyed.
Mm.
And so after the war, they rebuilt the plant.
Mm.
And they had enough of the old equipment, they could put it pretty well back together.
Yeah.
And they completed that and wanted to build a new car.
Uh-huh.
And they wanted some physical change to the car. So their chief engineer came over and we worked together for about a month. Designing it, they took the information back and did the car.
This is one of the projects for your special studio.
Yeah. And that was a lot of fun.
Did you do any advanced work? Was this in some way
well,
an advanced studio?
We did, but I can't remember what advanced work we did in the studio. And I wasn't there more than a year, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, I had a little physical problem. I had a stroke.
Mm-hmm.
And I was only 30 years old.
Had no inkling of this prior.
Well, I had high blood pressure.
That's right, you had that before.
But I didn't expect that.
They didn't have the sophisticated ways of treating high blood pressure they have today, did they?
I think not.
Specific medicine. You're just told, watch your diet, your salt intake, take it easy.
Somewhere along in there, I got on some medication. But
so you were off for a time?
I was off for a time, and after that, I went to, and this must have been about 1951, 50. I went to Chevrolet Studio as assistant chief designer. And that was under Ed Glowacki, Glowacke, who passed away in 65.
Rather early on.
Yeah, he was a young man.
Yeah. Something of a legendary figure that everybody talks about.
Yeah, yeah. Character.
How long had he been head of the Chevrolet Studio? Immediate post-war years,
yeah.
Been the Chevrolet designer. Were you
very good man.
Were you pleased with that assignment?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, Chevrolet.
Right, yeah.
Big wheel.
The bread and butter.
You bet.
I know.
And at that time, I got to meet all of the Chevrolet engineering people, and let's see, who was Ed Kelly, was chief engineer of Chevrolet.
Ed Kelly?
Ed Kelly.
The
So it was an exciting prospect.
Yeah, but again, the work that I was doing at the time was sort of a facelift of 49 car into the 52.
They had, much like most people in those days, had kept the model for about 3 years.
So that was interesting, but not exciting. And then the next one was 53 and 54.